we have to be quiet because the prayer book says we enter in silence. This is not a good joke for a podcast.
Everybody is like tapping on their earbuds, like what's happening.
So we're here to talk about Good Friday.
We sure are.
I'm David, I'm an organist.
And I'm Ian, and I'm a priest.
And this is All Things Right and Musical, the Good Friday episode.
Good Friday.
It's so austere, actually, we've omitted our theme music.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard that.
I didn't hear it.
Right.
Which is the point.
Exactly,
right?
It didn't come on.
Yeah.
There'll be no music this episode, as is traditional for the day.
Right.
I mean, in terms of instrumental music. Uh-huh. There's plenty of singing. Because you could sing the whole Passion if you wanted to,
right?
But one of the customs around this day is that you would not have any instrumental music or organ music,
and that comes from the fact that when stripping the altar, usually the pipe organ would be disassembled.
Not disassembled, but sometimes, yeah, sometimes if you had large wooden doors that would cover the pipework, they'd be closed for all of Lent, or if they weren't closed for Lent, you'd close them for Good Friday,
right?
Yeah.
So you don't take it apart.
It's just so much work. I mean, you wouldn't have time. Like, by the time you took it apart, it'd be Easter, and then you'd have to use it.
I mean, maybe you wouldn't have time.
It depends. Depends on how big a pipe organ we're talking about here.
One manual? I don't even know what that means.
You just said it.
It's just a word that right. I've heard referred to organs.
So a manual is a keyboard.
Yes.
So a one manual. Those are pretty rare that you would see a one manual organ.
Right.
The only one manual. Well, that's not true. I did play a one manual organ with a pedal board one time.
Uh-huh.
At a church in Vermont.
Uh-huh.
St. Barnabas in Norwich.
All right.
Very nice little organ.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Good Friday.
Good Friday. So, yeah, it begins in silence. No processional hymn.
Well, that's true, because it does say that you enter in silence.
Yeah.
And this goes along with what we were talking about in our episode from last week about Maundy Thursday, that liturgy actually does not end.
Right.
There's no dismissal right. to that liturgy. There's no blessing, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is you kind of put everything on pause until Good Friday, and then you pick it up.
Yeah, and if you plan on having communion on Good Friday, you actually consecrate it the day before,
mm-hmm.
In order to sort of not just in advance, but as a way of saying sort of this is part of the same thing.
Mm-hmm. That single celebration of the Eucharist on Maundy Thursday sort of carries over to Good
right.
Friday
if
if you want it to.
Yeah.
If you want to receive the sacrament on this day.
Right.
Yeah.
And Good Friday too, instead of beginning with, you know, an opening sentence or an opening acclamation or anything, it begins with a collect, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I do love the very beginning. It's optional in the prayer book.
Yeah.
But I do love that very beginning versicle and response that you can do.
Yeah.
Blessed be our God. And the people respond forever and ever, amen.
Right.
That is very stark.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the shortest acclamations we have
yeah.
at the beginning of a liturgy like this.
Right, right. So I should say that it doesn't have the sort of opening acclamations that we're used to.
Right. It's different.
Yeah.
Yeah, from the outset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you sort of jump right into the readings. You've got a few different options, and then you hear the Passion. And again, the Passion, just like it was on Palm Sunday, is introduced differently mm-hmm. than the Gospel normally would be.
Right. It's introduced as the Passion.
Yeah.
And there's no response to that.
Right.
And it can be sung the same way that you can sing it on Palm Sunday,
mm-hmm.
Divided up into three parts. You know, one thing we didn't talk about on Palm Sunday is that tradition of splitting it up into spoken parts. Because that expands that tradition usually beyond the kind of traditional three roles.
Right.
I mean, if you have a script for it, you're liable to involve, I don't know, eight or nine different people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Sometimes I find that to be a little bit like community theater hour at church.
It really can be.
Yeah.
That's the thing is, it you have to be...
Let me just say, I think it's harder to do that well
yeah.
than... to do it poorly.
I would agree with that. And that's not to say that you can't do it well or that no one should ever do it. But I think that places that do that as a default, just so that you're not hearing the same person's voice.
Well, but I think, see, we've gone to the other extreme. Like, when is the last time that you've ever heard a single person read the Passion Gospel? Like, it's not so long as to be prohibitive for a single person to do it. It's just you never hear it done that way.
I've heard it done that way.
Oh, have you?
I have.
Good. Thanks for proving me wrong.
I mean, it's not common.
No, it's not the usual,
but I have heard it done that way.
I mean, it is lengthy. I mean,
yeah,
I wouldn't really want to wish that on anyone either. So I see why it's, you know, I see why it's broken up. But yeah. I don't know. I just think we want to be a little bit more thoughtful about the way we're doing that as a church.
Right. Right. And having the different spoken parts, if it's not well rehearsed and it's not a well-oiled machine.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the hesitations, or you say a line in the wrong place, and we're talking about adults nine times out of 10.
Right.
And yet the effect that it gives is sort of like, you know, a poorly rehearsed Christmas pageant.
Yeah. 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 It can have that flavor.
And that's not the effect you want to have on this day.
No.
So it especially rubs me wrong if it's done poorly on Good Friday. I think it's especially disruptive within the solemn liturgy on Good Friday.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, because there is something different. Palm Sunday can in many other ways be treated like a somewhat different Sunday morning.
Sure.
But if you've got people who showed up for Good Friday, the odds are good that they're there for the Triduum, which means that that you want Good Friday to sort of to be a part of the whole, but to have the emphasis that it's meant to have. Mm-hmm. And it really can take you out of that if it has that sort of pageant feel.
Right. So then we get beyond the Passion Gospel. Oh, I always do like to stand at Golgotha.
Yeah.
This is the John reading is the one that has Gabbatha too, isn't it?
I think so.
And sometimes people hear that word and think it's Golgotha and they stand up.
Yes.
Have you ever seen that?
Yes.
Yeah, that's how. Luckily, they're not too far apart in the reading, so
right.
You're kind of okay if you
just stand up a little early.
Right. If you jump the gun, you're just up for a couple more lines.
Right.
And then the solemn collects.
Yes.
These are really lovely.
Yep.
And there was something that I didn't understand until I heard this done on a webcast in a very particular way, that the biddings are meant to be done by, the deacon.
Uh-huh.
And then the people kneel, and then the collects that follow, what we're actually referring to as the solemn collects, are then generally prayed by the celebrant or someone else.
Right. So no, usually by the celebrant.
Yeah. So it's actually...
In fact, that may be in the rubrics.
Well, I don't think it is, which is why I think...
It is.
Oh,
the biddings
really?
May be read by a deacon or other person appointed.
And then the celebrant says the collects. It does say it right there.
Yeah.
And yet, I had mostly seen that ignored in places that I've served.
Yeah.
So I think it is really nice when that... Well, it's a rubric. I think it is really nice when that rubric is followed, because it helps sort of make the relationship clear from the biddings to the collects and then the periods of silence in the middle. The other innovation or the other practice that I've seen around this is kneeling for those periods of silence. I think that helps. That helps break. I don't know. It helps give it some structure somehow.
Uh huh.
Have you ever seen that done?
Say that again. Kneeling for the...
Yeah, the other thing that I've seen done with this is that the deacon will actually give the instruction to kneel immediately before the silence.
Uh-huh.
At the end of the period of silence, he'll instruct people to stand up.
So prayers while standing?
There's biddings.
The biddings and prayers, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then kneel for the silence and stand up for the collect?
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen that done. Mm-hmm. And I feel a little weird about it.
Hmm. High church practice.
Is it?
I think it is. I'm gonna look it up here.
Hmm. It's one of those things that I don't know that it conveys what it's intended to convey.
Yeah, this is mentioned in Mitchell.
Uh-huh.
At the conclusion of each bidding, the deacon may say or sing, "Let us kneel in silent prayer." Mm. All kneel in place. The deacon says or sings, "Arise," and stands up. All stand, and the presider says or sings the collect.
Hmm.
Is that what you're reading in Mishnah too?
Yeah, the deacon may direct the people to kneel for the period of silence.
So that's part of the heritage around this.
I've never seen that done.
It's an, you know, it's another, like, obviously you're not going to have an invalid Good Friday liturgy if you don't
right.
do the standing or kneeling, but it's another thing like doing the Great Litany in procession.
Uh-huh.
Like, there's nothing wrong with doing the Great Litany in place,
mm-hmm.
but there is something about the movement just for the duration of that prayer that just gives it some more texture, gives it some more physicality,
mm-hmm.
In a way that I think is useful in focusing our prayer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think my hesitance around this has to do with the function of the silence and the function of the biddings. Because to me, these are like, it follows the form of the prayers of the people, right? And is structured like the prayers of the people, but there's a collect for each portion of it,
right?
Which to me gives it a more solemn feel, which I think is intended. But if you pray if the biddings are said while everyone's standing, and then you kneel for the silence, you're saying that this is somehow wildly or distinctively different from the prayers of the people, in that instead of just saying what we're praying for and actually praying for it that way, mm-hmm. we have to tell you what to pray for, and then you need to kneel in silence and do it on your own.
I don't know. I kind of like that. I kind of like being told what to do. At least on Good Friday, I'll listen to you.
All right.
Yeah. You know, as we're talking about this, I had a interesting idea that these solemn collects pulled out of this liturgy would make for a very interesting kind of service of lessons and music,
yeah,
in Good Friday. I mean, that would be sort of an interesting prayer service if you treated each of these collects as the head of a section, in a service like that.
Yeah,
and then after the solemn collects, you have an option to end the service.
Right, it
says the service may be concluded here with the singing of a hymn or anthem.
Yeah,
the Lord's Prayer and the final prayer. If you don't end the service there, then you typically do like a veneration of the cross.
If you don't end the service there, you usually have not always. I've seen some places not do veneration. But if you don't end the service there, usually you're going to have communion from the reserve sacrament.
Oh, right. That's the other element to this.
But yeah, those are the two sort of additional options, mm-hmm. that you can add on, which are the veneration of the cross and the communion of the reserve sacrament. I've seen places do communion without veneration of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I've seen anyone do veneration without communion. I don't know. I don't think I have.
I don't know either. I have to think about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it looks like the rubrics would permit that. So you could just add veneration of the cross with one of the anthems and end it there, and right. not do communion from the reserve sacrament.
Right. And these anthems are really lovely.
Yeah.
And they pop up in different pieces of choral music too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then there's something unusual on page 282.
Uh-huh.
There's a specific hymn mentioned by name in the rubrics.
Right.
The hymn, Sing My Tongue the Glorious Battle.
Right.
Or some other hymn.
Right.
Extolling the Glory of the Cross is that song. But it seems to have preference for that specific one.
Right. And the only place I can think of offhand where something similar happens is at ordinations, where Veni Sancte Spiritus is recommended.
Right.
At the ordination. But you're right. It is somewhat unique to sort of have a recommendation there. This is one really strongly suggested him, but other ones will work too.
That's right. There is actually, I had to flip back and check this.
Mm-hmm.
There is another hymn mentioned in Holy Week, which is on Palm Sunday.
Oh, in the after the Palms,
it does actually suggest all glory, laud, and honor.
Yeah, you're right.
It's not required, but it says such as the hymn, all glory, laud, and honor, and in the same way, it's mentioned by name.
Yeah,
yeah. But Good Friday is kind of a quiet service. I don't think there's too much more to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think
Except service time.
Oh, right. Yeah. Service time. Well, and communion from the reserve sacrament, mm-hmm. which I think is an interesting sort of focal point of Good Friday. I think that reading John's Gospel, which is much more, in some ways, what's the word? It's not as, you know, the synoptic gospel that you hear on Palm Sunday is much more realistic. It's much more sort of earthbound. And John's gospel, John's passion, just like John's gospel, is more soaring, mm-hmm. you know?
More cosmic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so there's something I think powerful about, in the context of the Triduum, knowing what Good Friday means in the grand scheme of things, hearing John's passion read. And the communion from the reserve sacrament, I think, sort of carries out that theme. The idea that even though this is an awful day in some ways, it is still Good Friday. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why we call it that. And even though we're saying we're not going to celebrate the Eucharist today because there's nothing to celebrate, we still think that communion is important because we want to convey that Christ is present even in this moment.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's really powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I say do communion from the reserve sacrament on Good Friday.
Yeah, because it's unavoidable, that difference.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden, here's communion made available, but the last time you saw it celebrated was the day before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then there's the issue of timing, right?
Right.
So increasingly common is this insistence on doing the proper liturgy for Good Friday only at noon on Good Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And this might even come from Mishnah.
We've mentioned these things by name, but you're reading from A Priest's Handbook by Dennis Mishnah.
So, yeah, and he says, the solemn liturgy of the Passion and Death of our Lord Jesus Christ should be celebrated in the afternoon or early evening hours. So he is not even as specific as people have gotten.
Yeah.
And it's worth mentioning, Mishnah is on the higher church end of ceremonial manuals,
yeah.
or manuals ceremonial. so if he's not even prescribing that this has to take place at noon, then I think there's a little more leeway in the tradition than some people think that there is. But he says for Good Friday evening, if the liturgy of the day takes place during the afternoon hours, a service at the end of the day may be pastorally desirable. Either evening prayer or the following form may be used. And for the following form, it's really sort of a commemoration. It's called the commemoration of the burial of our Lord Jesus Christ. And it's sort of a hybrid between Good Friday and Holy Saturday, liturgies. I don't love that practice. I don't love the message that unless you can be here at noon,
mm-hmm.
then you are not welcome to participate in one of the central liturgies of the church year.
But so it's interesting because what I was hearing you read in Mishnah, even though he doesn't specify which one, the implication seems to be that there is one. That seems to be important to
right.
his idea of the liturgical practice.
Yeah.
That this is a liturgy that's celebrated one time.
I think that there are potentially good reasons for that. Like I don't know a lot of places that do multiple Maundy Thursday liturgies.
No. And the least repeatable, Maundy Thursday is tough, especially if you're stripping the altar. Then what do you do?
Right.
Just dress it up again?
Right. Exactly.
The least repeatable, it seems to me, is the Easter Vigil.
Yes.
Because
no one has two vigils.
No. Because, it's got to be one.
Right.
I mean, whether you're doing it at sundown or sunrise, you know, whatever you have in mind for that service, it's something that happens once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So most places will have one Maundy Thursday liturgy, one Good Friday liturgy, one Easter Vigil, if they have all three, which mm-hmm. not everyone does, let's be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But the sort of notion that we've I think come to, or that a lot of people have arrived at, that we can only do Good Friday liturgy at noon on Good Friday because that's the hour at which Jesus hung on the cross,
mm-hmm.
is to me a misunderstanding of the function of time in liturgy. that these liturgies don't take place in everyday time.
Right.
And it is not important that we celebrate that we celebrate Good Friday at the moment Jesus was hanging on the cross, because you know what? He was in a different time zone anyway.
So you would make this case differently if we were recording this in Jerusalem.
No, I wouldn't. Because what's important about Good Friday is that this is part of the sequence. And what's important about Good Friday in particular is that those who were there at Maundy Thursday, who got the new commandment, who got the institution of the Eucharist, who got that Last Supper, and those who will be present at the Easter Vigil, who will be present at the resurrection, have that moment for lament in the midst of it. And if we say, the only way you're allowed to take part in this is if you take off work, because let's be honest, most people don't have Good Friday off work or off school anymore. If we say that's the only way you can participate in this, we've taken one of the few moments that really has the capacity for lament and for sadness in our liturgy, and really can bear the weight of everything awful that happens in the world. And we've said it's only open to you under these specific circumstances.
Yeah, that is tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would much rather places say, you know what? Forget what time traditionally we hold Jesus hung on the cross. Let's have Maundy Thursday and Good Friday at the same time in the evening when people can actually attend.
Well, let me be provocative here and say, what's wrong with doing Good Friday at noon and at 7 p.m. or whenever you think is convenient in the evening?
Well, I mean, that's also an option. I think you're right. It's definitely more repeatable than the Easter Vigil. And I think more repeatable too than Maundy Thursday.
And I guess the reason I'm suggesting that is because there is this tradition associated with the noon hour and this day. So I think that is meaningful to some segment of people still. I mean, I'm hypothesizing. So I don't want to take that away, but at the same time, I completely sympathize with what you're saying about this not being available to people, not being available to people outside of the noon hour, and I think it should be.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it can't be a both and.
Yeah, I don't know if even Mishnah says in here, nothing should detract from the total participation of all the people in the celebration of this liturgy. And I think that's part of it. You know, you want to have the community gathered to celebrate this moment together. But so
that's part of the impulse to have one service time, you're saying?
I think that's part of it. Yeah. I don't, whether you find that compelling or not is another, I think there are people who view this as a non-repeatable liturgy, that because it's part of a sequence, we shouldn't be doing it twice.
That's an interesting, concept.
Whether or not you find that compelling, that's an open question too.
Let's not settle that question. We'll leave it to our listeners to weigh in and tell us what to do.
Yeah.
Can I bring up a pet peeve?
Please.
That is the custom of choirs showing up for this, and clergy too, showing up to the service in cassock only, which is this like the equivalent of having a dream where you show up somewhere in your underwear. Those people are underdressed for that liturgy. Cassocks are street dress. And when you're in a service, you should be wearing cassock and surplice.
Okay.
And I brought some defense for this.
Did you?
Yeah, I don't think I've seen this written before, but I found a line about it in Mitchell.
Okay. I would love to hear it.
This is the Lionel Mitchell Lent, Holy Week, and Easter and the Great 50 Days Ceremonial Guide. Page 70. The older custom of wearing black vestments and the Anglican custom in some places of vesting choir and acolytes in black cassocks without surplices on this day tends to reinforce the funeral theme. This latter custom apparently stems from the recognition that the 3 hours was not a liturgical service, and hence vestments were not worn, but only the cassock, the street dress of the clergy. And I had never understood where that came from. I think it came from that 3 hours service tradition, which was typically a preaching service. And since it didn't come from the prayer book, I guess it was treated like For a non-liturgical service, you would just not wear a surplice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is Mishno would tend to agree with you, although he would, in a sense, at least. He says, note on vestments, and this is a bit lengthy, those seeking simplicity may wish to celebrate the entire Good Friday liturgy in alb and passion-tide red stoles. Others will want to be vested in chasuble for the entire liturgy. Those who seek to retain the chasuble for the communion may wish to use all or part of the following adapted from traditional Western use. And then goes on to describe this sort of tradition of changing vestments, but essentially prescribes alb and stole.
That's interesting.
At the very least.
And nowhere does he suggest cassock only.
Nope.
Yeah. I think that tradition is pretty widespread, and I'm doing my best to stamp it out.
No, you're right. I don't know that I've ever been anywhere that didn't do that for Good Friday, which is kind of fascinating because I you know, that's an aspect of the day that I hadn't really looked into.
Yeah.
But it appears that you're right, that that's not a...
So just let me say it again. Churches that wear cassocks only, you're celebrating Good Friday in your underwear. Just live with that for a minute.
Yep.
A little bit of levity in an otherwise stark Good Friday podcast.
You know what? You know what worries me the most about that tradition, though?
Tell me.
Is that I'm sure that there are priests who connect that to the stripping of the altar.
Oh, well, there's something I didn't think about, because you do see clergy take off their... So many of their vestments and change. Well, yeah, I guess I've seen that. Clergy take off Eucharistic vestments and change into black cassocks at the stripping of the altar.
Right.
So there is a vestment continuity that continues there. I had not thought about that. Choirs don't take off their surplices while they're singing Psalm 22. It'd be a little bit too complicated. Usually have enough trouble chanting Psalm 22 in the dark.
But here's what Mishno says. The celebrant and assisting ministers, having removed chasuble, dalmatic, and stole, come to the center and begin stripping the main altar.
So he's describing them in albs.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're the type of place that celebrates in cassock and surplice, and you have taken off the surplice in order to strip the altar, then I think it makes more sense.
I guess so. I'm just thinking about choirs. I mean, because I can't tell the clergy what to do. I mean, I can, but they won't listen.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't want my choir to show up in their underwear for anything. Except a concert. So I have choirs sing concerts in a cassock because that's not a service. So we don't put on surplices for concerts.
Right.
But if it's the Good Friday service, I don't think we're just dressing in black to be somber and funereal.
Yeah.
I think we should wear what we wear for every other service.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. But once again, the color is red.
There are places that have multiple color cassocks exactly for this contingency.
Oh no, I don't mean cassock color.
Oh, you're talking about the color of Good Friday?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of a non-issue, isn't it? Because the church should be stripped.
Yeah. But, I mean, Mishnah is saying you should be wearing vestments.
Oh, red. So he's describing red stoles.
Yeah, oxblood or passion tide red.
That's interesting.
Yep.
Should we wrap it up?
Yeah. I think that's all we've got for Good Friday, right?
Perhaps.
So thanks for joining us today for this episode of All Things Rite and Musical. If you've enjoyed this episode about Good Friday, we hope you'll tell us about it. You can find us on the web at riteandmusical.org. That's R-I-T-E and musical.org. You can also find us on Facebook, and you can interact with David and I and with other listeners of the podcast. So a special thanks to our generous patrons who support us and this show on Patreon. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
When we talk about
the Easter Vigil.